This is the required public meeting under Section 301(j)(9) of Article 62431 of the Vernon Revised Civil Statutes. The regular and supplemental meetings are called to order and then they're recessed. So this is that different required public meeting. And the first item we have, which there'll be other opportunities as well, is for public comments. Does anyone have anything they want to say? If not, we'll go now to Brenda to talk about the quarterly financial report.
Thank you, Nick. Good morning, everyone. I want to start the first quarter financial review with the first chart. Here we are. On page 3 of the presentation, if you're following along, we began the year with a preliminary net position of $1.95 billion. We had investment-related transactions that increased the net position of $82.8 million, and benefits and operations related transactions that decreased the net position by $26.5 million, and the March 31st net position is $2.01 billion, up $56 million since the beginning of the year. Next, I'm going to briefly discuss some highlights from the financial. So now we're on page 4. The combined statements of fiduciary net position compares the preliminary results from December 31st, 2023, to the results from March 31st, 2024. The first section is investments. Total investment value at March 31st was $1.96 billion. Compared to $1.875 billion at December 31st, or an increase of $85 million. And this increase is primarily related to changes related to market changes for equities and fixed income. As we move down the page and we look at cash and cash equivalents, cash decreased by almost $20 million. Since year-end, primarily due to benefit payments exceeding contributions during the first quarter. As we move on and we look at the combined statement of changes in fiduciary net position, this statement compares the results from March 31st, 2024, March 31st, 2023. And the first section is contributions. City and member contributions increased by $4.6 million compared to the same period last year. City contributions increased $3.2 million year over year. Contributions now exceed the floor and are based on comp pay plus the additional annual contribution of $13 million. Overall, member contributions increased by almost $1.4 million year over year because of increased salaries and headcount. Employee headcount has increased by 150 when compared to the same period last year. As we move down the schedule and we look at net investment income, it has increased by $7.3 million year over year, again, primarily related to the change in public markets. And as we continue down and we look at benefits paid to members, overall benefits paid to members increased by $1.6 million year over year. Service pensions increased by $1.1 million. And survivor benefits increased by $608,000. New service retirements at higher monthly benefits is the primary driver in the increase in benefits paid to members. Are there any questions about the financials? Thank you.
I'm up next with the contribution report. Again, just Nick said this at the beginning, but just to remind you, this is the weird required public meeting that we have twice a year. The second one is more informational because we have the actuarial evaluation. So the other part of this meeting is the monthly contribution report. And it is generally the same that you've seen, except for one exciting thing. For the first time since 2017, we actually have more employees on payroll than the hiring plan has, by 17 people. Never happened before. But that's good news. It's all in the fire department. There are 287 over there, and police is under by 270. The contributions came in as expected. We had two payrolls through the month of March, and we received $13.1 million from the city and about $5.2 million from the members. So we're on track with what we expected. Are there any questions on the contribution report?
It was 278 hired over.
There was 287 for fire and fire's over by 287.
So we're up by how many people? 18?
Yes, and police is under by 270. So we're in total up 17 people from the estimates that they had in 2017 when we did the legislation. And I know there's another fire class of 60 that's either started or will be starting soon. That's good.
Okay. So now we would like to adjourn that required public meeting. We have a motion to adjourn that meeting, this meeting. Second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Now we're going to go to the regular meeting, as we normally do. So we'd like to start off with a moment of silence for those who are not with us anymore. Thank you. Next, we'd like to go to the minutes from the April 11th meeting. Any comments or questions on those minutes? If not, we have a motion to approve the minutes.
Move.
Second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Now we have the second chance for public comment. Would anyone in the public like to say anything? John, anyone on the
five star on the phone? Raise your hand.
Okay. All right. Now we've never gone through the first page as quickly as we just did. So now we have the quarterly and monthly, but I assume we just did that, so that's satisfied that requirement. Next will be me reporting on the audit committee meeting you just had right beforehand. Had a chance to meet Jody Hildebrand, and she'll talk a little bit to us about the plan, but she seems incredibly experienced and competent. She's new to the assignment, but she's very experienced working currently with five other public pension plans, three here in Texas, two in Alaska. The team underneath her, Matt, and the others that we've dealt with are the same. So we're thrilled to have her on board. She actually is on the national basis the technical partner for a lot of pension plan clients. So we're thrilled to have her. We talked about the plan for the audit. We're hoping to have it done by late summer, although several of the things are not in our control, but to the extent we can try to move it forward, we're doing that. And now give Jody a chance to introduce herself, talk about the timing and so on, and any questions you have, she's willing to talk about anything.
I think you've done a great job with the introduction. I don't know that you guys can hear much more about me. I'm a part of CDO, and I am based in San Antonio, but in Dallas. So San Antonio doesn't count me as local. I've only been there 17 years, but Dallas doesn't count me anymore either. So yeah, that is. So we have acquired communications under our standards. That should give comfort to a lot of people on the board, because basically that means professionally I can't hide things from you just because I like Brenda and Kelly a lot. So we're going to run through the things that we're required to just to make sure that we're communicating. Feel free to interrupt and ask questions as we go through. As far as responsibilities, I have responsibilities in audit. You guys have responsibility for oversight. That means I'm required to communicate certain things to you, and you're required to communicate certain things to me. So that's why we ask certain board members, you know, are you aware of any fraud? Is there anything you're concerned about? Anything that happened during the year that you would know is unusual? All those kind of things. Just because you're doing an audit doesn't mean you don't have responsibility for financial oversight of the pension. And so that's just one of the things that we want to make sure that we're clear about is who owns what responsibility. Ultimately, you're responsible for the financial. So there's a lot of words on this page about the audit strategy. It just means that when we do planning, there's a lot of things that we look at. We look back, we see what happened in the past. We look at clients that are comparable and kind of see what's happening with them within the industry. We also look at any changes that have been made. The only real change this year to the audit strategy is that we are trying to take a new approach on how we are auditing the Huff and the Lone Star investments, just because the audit has kind of been held back, I think, by not being able to kind of tangibly determine that those investments are materially accurate. So Brenda's kind of come up with a plan working through that to make sure that we can ideally hit the July deadline to stay happy this year and look at it in a different way. And that means kind of how can we look at it analytically? How can we look at the underlying things that are going on, especially for Huff, and we know what those look like and correlate those to kind of the investment value so that we can provide more real-time information to move forward on. We do use technical tools. Most important thing, I think, is that we have a secure portal where we transmit everything that we keep. We feel like PII is a very important part of what we do. Keeping that safe is just as important as doing an appropriate audit. So we do have security measures in place so that no one's going to gain access. No bad actors are going to have access to your pensioners and active employees records. We're required to communicate our scope. It's listed here. Fraud is required on every single audit, so just know that just because that's the first thing that's on here, that's a statutory requirement. That's not necessarily because we think it's more pervasive here than anywhere else. We look at internal controls just to assess whether they're accurate, not whether they're appropriate for your organization. We don't actually test them to make sure that they're operating effectively. We do work with the actuary. We use the actuarial valuation and the inputs to make sure that the plan is operating in compliance. How it is written. We look to make sure that minimum funding and that kind of thing is happening. The bulk of our focus is always on investments. It's the biggest thing you guys have going on. And we do so pretty closely. Previously mentioned, we're trying to look at a different way of approaching some of that. We look at any related party transactions just in the government setting, right? Those are important. So we're going to look at, okay, what vendors are you paying? We make sure that it's not someone's, you know, brother-in-law, sister's cousin, or something like that, that kind of trickles down through the rules. There's a lot of detail on the following pages that I'm not going to go into because, honestly, I don't know that it's that helpful and impactful. The timeline is on here. This is probably the most important thing right now. We're working on planning, I think, starting next week officially. We're going to do confirmations. We will be in the field. Partially this month for planning in June and July. It's the goal of wrapping everything up and being able for you guys to file with the state by the end of July. I'm sure if anything occurs between now and then, you'll be informed that it might not meet that deadline. Independence, I think, is knowing that you have to be independent. That line in our engagement letter, which I think is going to be executed hopefully later today, it just basically says that governmental standards and benefit plan standards have a higher level of independence that's required than among other, like, commercial audits. So we're required to be independent, and that looks very far down and looks at relationships. So. We have reports on our system of quality management that are out here. This is amazing. It's reported by our oversight authority, the AICPA. Now we're actually required to report on our internal controls to you so that you can kind of see what kind of things we have in place to make sure we're doing the things that we're supposed to do. We have certain resources available for boards if you so desire to look at it. It's available for to satisfy certain mandatory training requirements that you have at the board level. So, and these things are available on our website if you were to desire to go. We do have an audit committee practices report. This is a blend of commercial and public companies, and so because of that, it may not be certain things of governance are universal. Certain things of governance are very specific when you're dealing with a governmental pension. So some of them are different. I can go through this, but we talked about this. Just trends that we're seeing right now, ESG. We talked in the other meeting. I think we're going to land is if you want to invest based on it, you can. If you don't want to, you don't have to. I think that's the appropriate response. And then just a little bit about resilience. Again, a little bit of this is just kind of a little bit of PR and lovely things from BDO. And then the last thing is cyber. That is something that we take pretty seriously, and we, as part of the audit, bring in IT specialists to look at the system to make sure that the firewalls and all that kind of good stuff are accurate, just because I'm an accountant and I am not an IT specialist. So we want to make sure that the people looking at it are the people who really know what they're talking about. There are some publications that we also have on security issues. There are some new GASB standards that are out there. Quite honestly, none of them really are impactful to the pension, but we are required to kind of communicate under the standards of the new ones that are out there. And that's it. Does anyone have a question?
I actually have a question.
Okay.
So, Jody, you said that you and Brenda are going to come up with a methodology of trying to get our numbers done by July. And our biggest issue, in my opinion, is HUP. And the variance has been incredibly wild from year to year. So are you, this methodology that you're coming up with, is it going to be something that you come up with evaluation but then gets reinstated once we get the final numbers? Is that kind of the thought?
So I think part of it is we're getting the inputs right, and so we're getting the reserve reports and all of that kind of information. So essentially we're looking at the inputs that the auditor or HUF is going to essentially look at to determine kind
of. And who is that auditor?
Gosh, I don't even know who that is.
I thought it was BDO.
No.
No.
HUF's auditor isn't.
Oh.
I Bailey.
Okay. I Bailey. Okay.
So, Tina, I think that is, would be the third option. And it would be, because it would cost us a lot to do the valuation and redo the valuation.
Right.
So I
right.
think that the options would be, we get the information that we can from HUF, and we get it valued externally like we did, if we can, that's preferable. If we can't, I have seen a valuation where they actually still update the audit for the numbers, but the valuation gets adjusted on a lag.
Yes, on a lag, that's what I was asking.
We don't redo the valuation.
Okay, so you just... Okay.
So that's a backup, but
that's the
redoing
backup.
The whole valuation would be the third choice. Hopefully we don't go there.
And it's Eisner Ampner, not Ibailey. Yeah.
It's just an ongoing issue, that's all. So I just like to hear that it's going to be somewhat challenged, but
so part of it is we're just trying to look at it and say, okay, historically when we look back at it, what's the reserve, the relationship of their reserves to what before we end at final value? What's the relationship of the return based on kind of their holdings as compared to other E&P companies in a similar, in the industry and that kind of thing? You can imagine in Texas we do a lot of E&P company audits, and so we have internal resources that we can then kind of leverage to, okay, we also have lots of funds, we have a big fund practice, and so we're going to kind of try and reach into some of that stuff and see, okay, if we look back, do we see that there's something that, that historically, if we look at these six factors that combined together, we can pretty much track kind of the reasonableness and how we're getting to their fair value? If so, if we apply those this year, do we get where we need to be? And it may be, like we said, what's material for the audit and what they want to adjust for the actuary is very different. So we would issue an audit report. If that number changed, we wouldn't go back in the audit and change the prior year, because quite honestly, it would have to be pretty significantly off to materially impact the financial statement. And when I say significantly off, I mean,
that house has done that.
No, the estimate produced by management would have to be so significantly off from the audited numbers. And we know from just historical, right, that the estimate isn't that materially different. It may change materially year over year, but management statement would get pretty close. And so that's kind of how we're tracking it. But I know that a lot of time the actuary will go back and they want to true up the beginning of the year so that they just look at things differently.
Thank you.
Anything else? Okay. Well, Jody, thank you, and we look forward to working with you. Appreciate you coming up from San Antonio. All right, now we're going to talk about the Section 2.025 update. Just as a little bit of an overview, we had thought that perhaps we would have something, a recommendation that we could vote on this month. We've been in real active dialogue with the city, particularly Mayor Pro Tem Mel Atkins and other people, you know, Jack Ireland, the CFO, and Tammy in the legal office, and others. And, you know, we sort of developed, I think, kind of the bid ask on most of the issues. Obviously, the one that matters most is the adoption of the concept of an ADC. Because that is the most substantial thing that allows us to fall in compliance with the PRB guidelines and the 30-year funding, and the significant increase in funding from the city. The glide path of when it becomes sort of fully in effect is part of our bid ask. And then we've been pretty adamant on wanting to have a COLA that has much more substance to it than what is there right now. And other than the inflation index, the CPI, you know, eliminate other contingencies around that. And I would say we have a little bit of a wider ask on that issue right now. They've also talked about other issues involving governance, which, you know, to a certain extent, the structure and legal setup, you know, with some limitations and what they can do, but we're open to what suggestions they have.
Nick, can you go into specifics about governance and what are the...
Not really, because it's been a moving target a little bit of things they've talked about. I think the biggest issue, and I've told them several times, I completely understand where they're coming from, is by adopting, you know, the ADC, you know, there's a whole basket full of risks that you could argue they really didn't own, or they directly owned, or they partially owned, and now they fully own, because, you know, that is a number that's derived from a bunch of factors like investment returns and other things that they don't control. So that is, you know, a significant change, but really it's the only way to come to a solution, and they seem to be on board with that as a concept. So the implementation of it and the glide path is still up for negotiation. So to that end, in speaking with Mayor Pro Tem Atkins and others, you know, we both sort of agree. They have their ad hoc tension meeting, and I'm not sure if they're actually meeting today or not, but we have an agreement that neither group would vote on a plan today as we kind of continue negotiations. I suppose all of you could sort of, you know, want to do that, notwithstanding, you know, my recommendation and Kelly and Josh's recommendation on this. So, you know, we're free to do what we need to do, and we obviously need to comply with the law, which is we do need to adopt the plan sometime this year. But in the spirit of working towards a solution and avoiding or working through the conflict that exists today, and, you know, not wanting to beat down the state legislature next year, but knowing that that is a viable option if we can't come to an agreement, we both sides agreed not to vote on a plan today, but obviously I think if the will of all of you were to do that, you could. It would be my recommendation and Kelly's recommendation not to do that and allow us to continue to work through the issues and try to find common ground.
I would just add that, you know, there's really no reason for us to make a decision right now when the negotiations are still progressing. And to me, it shows good faith for us to let this simmer and cook a little bit. So I have there's no magic to making a decision today. So
I just wanted to highlight that we have a recommendation on it, but that, you know, that I don't represent the majority of the board.
Do we have a summary of where the bid and ask?
Well, I was doing nothing more than setting the table for the person.
I was just trying to get it.
And I will tell you that Kelly is a stud. She knows more information about every aspect of this than anybody else. So having her guide us through this process is just incredibly, I mean, it's great because she really knows her stuff, every step on every issue.
But I will say, in order to understand the other point of view and other side, we have to hear it or know it, and we don't know it.
Right. Well, I think we might be able to maybe get some information on it, but the whole point of it is we're in a public setting here. We definitely don't. Those conversations have been going on in negotiations between parties. I don't know if this is the forum to hear that.
Well, Kelly has a presentation. Let's get through it, and then we'll see where the discussion takes.
So the other thing that I would add, and maybe you said this, Nick, and I missed it, there is some talk about canceling the pension committee meeting this afternoon and then scheduling a special meeting of their committee on the 23rd, 2 weeks from today. And I think my staff was going to poll you all to see if you happen to be available that day, because if something moves in this negotiation and, you know, we're all in agreement, it would be great if we could meet when at the same time, you know, the same day as their meeting. So that's what that's about. If they have their meeting today, I don't know if they're going to try to do another meeting in 2 weeks or not. That's what that's all about. So if we reach out to you seeking a special meeting, I can't imagine it would be a long meeting, but that's what that's about.
So the meeting doesn't include, I mean, it's internal to the city, right?
The meeting, no, this is a meeting, it's the ad hoc pension committee meeting that has been meeting. It's eight council, Mayor Pro Tem Atkins chairs it, and there's eight council members, including himself, on the committee. So they've been meeting every Thursday after our board meetings in the afternoon.
And that
committee will make a recommendation to the full council. But they would, my understanding is, take a vote, and that would go to the full council.
Okay. So when, I'm just curious, when are the negotiations take place when the ad hoc group meets?
No, the negotiations have been between conversations with Jack and I primarily, but and then with Nick and Mayor Pro Tem Atkins. The new interim city manager was in the last one. We've had Josh and their legal counsel in some of them as well. So we've had a variety of meetings, not as many as I would have hoped, and we haven't made as much progress as I would have hoped. But we're working on it.
The other thing I would add on the timing is the statute requires
the board to adopt the plan by November 1st. So there's still more time. Now, the city has their own various constraints, and I've heard, you know, there's always lots of voices from the city, lots of different opinions for different things. You know, they're aiming towards finalizing their budget in June, and that's why they want a plan that's done so they know more definitively the numbers. Now, I've also heard that they can have budget amendments. They recess in July, and they come back in August and adopt the budget by the end of September, starting October 1st. So I don't know exactly what flexibility there is or isn't on the city side to kind of continue this if we don't reach a deal by then. And so this week, the board can certainly, you know, I would use the phrase hang out until the fall and adopt a plan and still be in compliance with the statute. Now, if the city, I don't know if the city is amenable to that or not. So there's still possibly more runway to get something done. Maybe not. We don't really know. But that's kind of the timing aspect of everything.
The other technicality of this is we've been talking to you of we're going to adopt a plan. Well, what is the first step would be that you all agree on or recommendations and tell us to go start draft. And I would really think at this point we can actually start drafting the plan now with, you know, kind of our recommendations and then tweak it as we go. But what would happen is when we get to a point, whenever that is, the board will say, go draft language that matches these recommendations. And then we would bring that and you would formally adopt that. Is that right?
Yeah, I think really at the end of the day, and I will pause here and tell you, just as there's not a lot of agreement on the side of the funding aspect of things, there's also on the legal side, right now there's not a lot of agreement between myself and the city attorney on how legally and mechanically this gets adopted and pushed forward. But having said that, what Ellie and I contemplate is that the board would, under the 2.025 requirement, you would formally adopt changes to our statute, and that's what we would present to the PRB as the board's plan. And that's ultimately the ultimate goal here on our part.
Okay. All right. So just clarification. So the deadline for adopting the plan is November 1st, drop deadline. Is there a mandate on when it actually is implemented? Or that depends on whatever the plan we decide on. Like if it's
so the statute says that it is in effect once it's adopted.
Okay.
Held, and it stays in effect until the legislature changes it. So technically, you know, I guess we could adopt it today if we had something to adopt and we had language written and all of that, and it would be in effect. We don't intend to do that. We would like to work on the timing that we've all talked about with the city, you know, come to an agreement. Everybody knows the numbers. They can build it in their budget. Starts with their new fiscal year. That's what the plan. The plan timeline. Okay? All right. So what I have for you today is 29 slides. The good news about these 29 slides is the first third of them you have seen most of them before. But I've included them here because I fully recognize this is not your full-time job and you do this once a month. So some of it is just to remind you of what we talked about before, just to see if you have any questions. So my intent is to go through these kind of the first nine-ish slides pretty quickly, but feel free to interrupt me. The new thinking since the last meeting really has to do with the COLA, which is about the last kind of two-thirds of the presentation. So if you're thinking you've seen this before, you probably have. So the first thing is, Chiron was hired based on the requirements of the plan. They had three primary recommendations: to pay city contributions based on the ADC, to reduce employee contributions as the funding level improves, and to provide some cost of living adjustment earlier. So that was our starting point. This is a new slide. I put it in here just so you have one place early on where you know what my recommendations are at this point. The ADC recommendation that I have, of course I prefer the traditional, but I'm recommending the three-year step up, which is what item one is talking about. Item two is I am not recommending employee contributions. I'll talk, I mean, reduction to employee contributions. I'll talk more about that a little bit later. And then where I've refined my thinking is really on the COLA, and I'm recommending a two-part COLA and modifying the current COLA, and I have a lot of slides on that.
Do you want to just mention kind of where the city is, so when we go through it, or
yes,
do I do that later?
I'll mention as I go through each one, generally. So this slide you've seen before, and as you, I'm sure, recall, Chiron recommended five different options on how to implement the ADC over time. So you calculate the ADC, and you either go to 100% of the ADC initially, or you phase that in a pattern. This order, one through five, was their most preferred to their least preferred. For the pension plan itself, the traditional is obviously the most preferred from us, but we do recognize the city has budget constraints, and it's a big increase. So I have moved all the way down to item four, which is the second to least preferred, which was a three-year step-up. The city is still at a five-year step-up. That's where they've been, and the CFO has told me he is not moving off that. So that's where we are. This slide, you've seen it before. The top one is the ADC millions, the total dollar amount under each of four of the options. The bottom part shows the year-over-year increase of each of the options. What I wanted to point out is under the traditional, for the first 5 years, a DCFP would receive $1.3 billion. Under the option that the city prefers, it's $1.2 billion, so it's roughly $105 million less over the five-year period. I have gone halfway with my recommendation. So instead of, you know, I am, the recommendation that I have here reduces what we would get under the traditional by half. So this, just to show you, we have moved, the city has not moved in this particular instance. I did point out, I think at the last meeting, that the five-year difference between the five-year step-up, step-down, and the five-year step-up is not materially different in those first 5 years, and that is what has been vocalized as a concern from the city. This five-year step-up step-down is better for the pension than the five-year step-up because basically it takes some of those back-end loaded contributions and moves them forward a little bit. This slide just shows you year over year, or each year, how much contributions under the step-up options are not going into the fund compared to the traditional each option there. This slide shows the percentage of the ADC under each of the options. You can see if the step-up causes a delay in contributions going into the fund, and since there's a delay, future contributions are higher. It hasn't changed.
Kelly, is there any discussion about maybe some kind of threshold parameter that would kick in an additional payment as a way to kind of bridge the timing differences? You know, if there were certain parameters met, you know.
The closest thing to that is there has been conversations about various ways to get a lump sum payment in, whether that pension obligation bonds or selling assets or something like that. And that's part of the city's current recommendations that I think that they're talking about. There's two ways to really look at that. If a lump sum payment going in, if you just apply it as it normally would, what it does is reduces the ADC for the city going forward, which is a good thing,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't really move the funding level up to kick a COLA in sooner. So depending on how you structure any lump sum payment, could move the funding level up sooner, or it might just reduce what the city needs to put in. So those are things to think about. But there's nothing in that first 5 years contemplated of coming in.
The issue for them is the amount of the payment that they're trying to stretch it out.
Yes.
If there was some alternative mm-hmm. there, that would obviously reduce
it would.
Payment,
right.
Which would be attractive for them, right?
Of course, yes.
Is there still discussion about a lump sum payment? And they're open to it, or have they?
Oh, no, they are open to it. I think the timing of it is the issue.
Well,
so
we're not willing, I mean, if something is best efforts, we can't call it conclusive today. So they've talked about best efforts triggers or perhaps the type of goal that we're looking for, but if it still has the best efforts wrapper on it, then we wouldn't say now that we've delivered a goal. We've said that there's a good faith, best efforts, something down the road, but we just can't call that certain.
I was just trying to think, is there some kind of creative way to bridge the timing gap on, because everybody's agreed on the ADC, but the timing of when it goes in some way.
Right.
Kind of, where is that?
Well, and I think actually one way to bridge the timing gap is what's shown here on the blue slide, I mean on the blue bars on this slide. That's the five-year step up, step down. And what happens is, instead of just doing the five-year step up, which really just kicks the can down the road, as you can see with the purple bars, it just really delays the money all the way out 25 years. Whereas this other one takes those last payments and kind of pushes them forward. So even though you've delayed 5 years, you're getting more in those next 20 years that helps you.
Yeah.
So that's kind of one way to do it. But the base recommendation that I have is the orange bars, which delays it for the whole time frame too, but not as much as the 5 years. The difference between the 3-year step up and the traditional in the first 5 years is about 3.7% less going into the fund, and the 5-year step up is about an 8% less money going into the fund in the 5 years.
And all these are options that Chiron recommends. We're not going rogue and taking what they said and said, you know, we're looking to enhance it or approve it. We're operating within the menu options that they provide.
But any money that would come in from whatever source earlier would reduce what the city has to put in. So there would be some motivation there for the city to do that. Or it would achieve funding sooner to help pay for a COLA.
I mean, if the lump sum was meaningful and this chart looks such that you do want a more kind of like thin path, you don't want this volatile strip up and down, but like if it was tethered to a lump sum up front, wouldn't the 5-year step up be a little bit better or okay or agreeable?
Yeah. And there was some guarantee.
Yeah, guaranteed.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean?
Okay. But they can't guarantee because they don't control market conditions for POV and they don't control sale of assets. So that they're never going to guarantee
a lump sum.
There's a mechanic in place that if a lump sum comes in, then it is a great outcome, and it reduces the ADC that they have going forward.
But that's in any scenario that it's going to reduce.
Yeah. And they talked about that relative to the COLA as well. But, you know, what we've said is that, you know, there's only one variable that should affect a COLA, and that is the consumer price index.
Yeah.
You know, and they've talked about it relative to returns and, you know, ability.
Oh, the COLA?
Yeah. And we, in our position has been, and that's not, you know, that's not, we're, we only want to say that we have something if we can say there's certainty around it.
And it's a response to the CPI, i.e. inflation.
Well, I'm saying that, yeah, I mean, that the amount of a COLA goes up and down with changes in CPI, not with investment returns, not with other factors.
So that was a whirlwind trip through the ADC, but none of that was really new information. Do you have any questions on the ADC before I move on? Okay. So the next item relates to, is the second Chiron recommendation. And the board had put the reducing the employee contributions as its third priority. And I did not do a good job talking about this at the last meeting because, in my mind, it made sense. Well, it still makes sense to have it third, and I knew we were dealing with a limited pool of money, and I knew that this was an area that we agreed with, so I kind of just blew past it, and that was wrong, and I apologize for that. What I should have spent more time explaining for any members that are hearing this is why I'm not recommending that we push for this. And my thinking on this was, the way that Chiron had it modeled, reducing the COLA didn't start until 2041. So even if you're on employee's day, you'd basically be here 15, 16 years. You'd be halfway through your career. So you would start to have a small decrease in your employee contributions as a brand new employee starting today in 2041, halfway through your career. And employees that are already here would be even further into their career than that. And I thought that a COLA that somebody would have over the rest of their lifetime in retirement was much more valuable to the employee. Not that I'm not saying that 13.5% of is not a big hit. It is a big hit, and it's hard for employees to pay that, especially with housing prices that they are and grocery prices and gas and all of that. It was kind of my judgment of limited dollars, what's best longer term for the employees. And that was my recommendation. But I have heard from some employees that they kind of felt like we just gave up on that. But that was the thinking there. Matt, did you want to say anything? Because Matt alerted me to the fact that people were not happy with this. And I totally get it.
Yeah. And I talked about this briefly last month, but like from what you're telling me, the city's already drawing hard lines in this negotiation 5 years. So if the city's already willing to negotiate on certain points, then I feel like if we're doing a disservice to the active members by not keeping this on the list as an ask at this point, since this is all a negotiation. I'm realistic in saying that I don't think our employee contribution rate should drop to where it was before all the changes the legislature happened back, sub 10%. I believe that having a benchmark or having a plan in place for the active employees' contribution rate to drop at perhaps a benchmark or a point in the future, even if that point is not a point where I will get any benefit, is something that should be done. Because I don't think we can leave it up to the city to do it on just their own, just because they want to. They're not going to do that. I firmly believe the city is not going to unilaterally decide they're going to lower this contribution rate. So I think this is our one opportunity to put that in place, even if it's for members who haven't even been hired. I do believe we're paying more than we should be, but I also understand that COLA is more important. If I had to weigh them, then I'm with you, Kelly, and if I'm prioritizing, I would say that it should come third, but I don't think it should be removed from our ask.
I agree with that.
I think at this point, I mean, we should be making a little harder case for all three of the recommendations by Chiron. Why are we so quick to cut one out at all? So I said my piece. The active members right now are bearing the weight of the mistakes made by those that came before them. They've been bearing it for a while, and they're leaving because of the contribution rate, more so than because of the COLA. A member that's 25 years old isn't thinking about COLA. Yes, they should be, but they're not. They're thinking about what they're doing at home every month. That's why they're working 2 or 3 years now. So it matters a lot to the active members. So the number one issue that I'm talking about, well, first off, it's the solvency of the pension, and it's also our contribution rate.
No, I mean, I think that's a fair point. The one thing I would just ask you all to always keep in mind is that, even though that we seem to sort of be on the same page with ADC, the fact that the city is willing to adopt an ADC is unto itself a huge, significant change and a huge willingness to take on risks directly that they weren't taking on before. Now, we could argue that indirectly, they've borne the risk of investment returns and, you know, all sorts of other things. But adopting the ABC, they're taking all that on right in front of them. And the adoption of the ABC speaks to the core continued health of this pension. And I'm trying to think about it from the perspective of people you're talking about, that they understand the pain point of the contribution rate. People understand the pain point of the lack of COLA or the COLA being, you know, beyond their reach. It's probably hard for them to understand the pain point of just the core, you know, blowing up, they're dissipating in your face. But first and foremost, that's what we're fighting for, which is that. And that if you look at it, and the dollars speak to the issue, if you look at the incremental amounts on those two issues, they're incrementally not a lot compared to taking on the ADC. Mm-hmm. And part of our way that we're trying to work the common ground is to highlight that. Every dollar matters, and there's a whole discussion on the city's part where we have a lot of empathy, but it's not our job to really think through that with them, which is how are they going to fund all of this. And if all dollars really are fungible, the incremental amount for the COLA request and perhaps for what we're talking about in the employee contribution are not that much of a percentage basis more. They are meaningful dollars, but getting the ADC in whatever form we work out done really does put the fund on a path where the core health is there. Perception, you know, the actual, you know, looking at the degradation of purchasing power by the lack of a COLA that Chiron really did a great job of highlighting really was kind of eye-opening to us and was a real help and aid in us taking on that position. But I just kind of want everyone to acknowledge and see that the ADC unto itself is the big, big, big thing here. Not that the other things are not absolutely important, but in our view, not as important, while still critically important, as the adoption of the ABC.
I mean, I like to look at things very simply, and maybe because it's very complicated. And when you look at the ADC, ADC means everything about the health of the pension. Without it, we cannot survive. I mean, we are sub 40% funded. I mean, this is disastrous in any other city, in any other place. So the ADC is imperative. It's the most important part if we're going to prioritize. When we look at COLA, we look at contribution rates, we're looking at the sponsors of this thing and how we're going to handle that going forward. But we're looking at prioritizing, right, but not taking it off the table. And you could even look at it as the COLA being something that retirees can no longer affect their income. It is what it is. It's a set. So anything that's adjustable is for inflation, and that's kind of really important because they can no longer affect what's coming in for them. And that's a big deal. And that's, you know, when you look at the PRB and its guidelines and that inflation, we have to assure that there is a retirement in place, but that it does not depreciate as we go forward and things become more expensive. And lastly, I do think the contribution has to be still on the table, but I also think it's something that should be addressed once hurdles are met. You know, and maybe that's just me, but I feel like if we already came into this situation saying that the legislature said to us that we have to be at 70% funded before we even consider a COLA discussion or things like that, I think it's more directed to contributions more than COLA in some ways. But again, that's how I'm just kind of like thinking about the situation. But none of those two things can be spoken until we have the ADC in place, is my opinion. But it's all packaged, though. It's all packaged, right? So My concern is that in our recommendations, we address all of these, right? And then we're getting pushback on the other side. Is their priority the same as ours? Like, do they see it that way, or they're not? Are there some, like, for example, if we say that, you know, we're out, we can look at reducing contributions when ADC is put in place and some sort of mechanism of COLA is. I mean, like, I'm confused. It's just a lot to kind of package.
They're interested in complying with the statute. I mean,
they are interested.
Yeah, they fully own that and recognize that. And that is why I think we have general common ground on the ADC, even though the slope of the hill is a little different right now. They get that. I have not seen any signaling that they feel otherwise. The things that we're attaching to it that I think Chiron highlighted, that's us pushing it. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of what their interests are, they don't have obviously they want public safety, but this is us pushing this on them. They just want to comply with the statute in a way that works for them with their budgetary constraints. So they're just coming at it from a different place, and that's conflict, and how you work through conflict is what, you know, these things are all about, and that's what we're doing.
To that point on the employee contribution rate decrease, would there be any harm in trying to negotiate when the fund is meets its actuarial assumption and is actuarially that would be a point in time where it's going to be hardwired into the negotiation.
Yeah, I think that's a good suggestion.
We'll have to technically figure out how to do that, because what we're in right now is this unique time frame where we can change things in the plan. But that time frame expires in 2025 and this provision goes away. So then there's other provisions in there on how you increase benefits. So we just have to read through that, technically how. But I hear you. We'll do.
So in layman's terms, let's lock in the ADC and then deal with the other issues? Is that what you're saying?
No.
At some point?
Just don't take it off the table right now. Just keep it as a point of negotiation, and if we have to pull it, we have to pull it. But
okay.
Hardball, they're playing hardball.
Yeah. But just to be clear, we're putting COLA as a higher priority than
yeah.
the
and I'm like with you. I agree.
Yeah. So
yeah.
And we want to move with the consensus on like board, and that's the consensus in session. Yeah.
You don't want to
yeah.
muddy the water.
I just think that we should just get consensus of that. But that's in fact our priority and our recommendation.
A couple of meetings ago, I think the board put those in the
yeah.
in the order,
yeah.
ADC, COLA, and then the employee contribution.
Yeah.
It's always been on the list.
Okay.
Right now, we don't have the top two buckets. So, okay, moving on. So now we're switching to the COLA conversation. And as I said, this is where my thinking has been refined, I guess, since the April meeting. You'll recall I gave you kind of three options for a COLA that Chiron had recommended, but I didn't identify one. I was made aware of a document that the Pension Review Board adopted in 2018 that has really influenced my thinking on how to structure the COLA, and that's kind of where a lot of this is coming from. I provided the full document for you. It's very short, a page and a half or less, in your materials after this presentation if you want to take a look at it. But in 2018, they adopted a document called Principles of Plan Design, and it says that the PRB intends the principles to guide and inform public retirement systems and the associated governmental entities on how to structure retirement plans. There's only 12 principles. Two of them, I think, are really appropriate to this conversation. The first one was principle number 5. Benefits should be designed to place employees on a path to financial security and retirement in consideration of participation or non-participation in Social Security. Chiron didn't recommend any changes to the benefits, even though the benefits are very modest for a plan that doesn't have Social Security. So that, I think, makes their principle number 8, the next bullet, even more important, where it says retirement benefits should be protected against the erosion of the benefits value due to inflation. Such benefits should not exceed actual inflation and should be funded in accordance with the Pension Review Board funding guidelines. And really, in thinking about this plan design, this is saying what should happen. And I've heard a lot from the city of the PRB is not requiring us to do a COLA, and that's true. But to have a well-designed plan, mm-hmm. especially when we're making changes and the independent actuary says it's important, I think it's important to do a COLA that kind of meets these principles. So that's where all this is coming from. In a perfect world, the solution that I would give you with all that in mind, let's implement a COLA based on the CPI and let's start it immediately. Voila, that's very simple, right? But that's very expensive. And I don't think we could get that approved by the city just because of the cost. So that has led me to a complicated structure, which I'm going to lay out today in the next, 20 slides and hopefully try to piece it together. Two of these pieces you've seen before, but I've refined my recommendation. One of them is completely new. It actually came out of a meeting that Nick and I had with Mayor Pro Tem Mack when we were talking about kind of an interim. So what I have here is basically a two-part COLA with modifications of the current COLA. So a new concept I'm calling the bridge COLA, and that is a bridge until the new COLA comes in. That's the first item. You haven't seen that before. The next item is the new COLA. We talked about that the last time, and that's the Chiron recommended COLAs. I've narrowed the three items I gave you before to one of the COLA options, and I'll talk about why I'm recommending the current COLA and the 70% purchasing power option, and then modifying the current COLA that's in the statute. And I talked about that a little bit at the end of the meeting last time, and I'll review that as well. So I apologize in advance for the confusion, but I think it meets the goals of what we're trying to accomplish with COLA. So I'm not going to go over all the slides you've seen before, but just to remind you, Chiron modeled 6 COLA options at their February 8th presentation, and then we asked them to do some more. So at the April meeting, you saw 9 COLA options. From there, I recommended the bottom bullet here, and I recommended of the 9 options that we were looking at, that the board consider what we were calling the supplemental payment and current COLA, the current 70% purchasing power, or the immediate partial and current COLA. So I gave you 3 options. I've narrowed this down to picking the middle one, 70% purchasing power, after I had to think about it and do some analysis. So again, we just talked about this. Long-term health is still the board's top priority. The board indicated that a COLA is still very important. The secondary priority, the COLA that is being recommended fits squarely in the PRB's adopted guidelines. And then the last part of that principle, where was it? This last part of the last bullet where it says, it should be funded in accordance with the Pension Review Board's funding guidelines. What they mean there is don't put a COLA in there and not value it in your valuation. So that's what that's talking about. Okay, this is just a reminder slide. Here are the initial COLAs that we talked about and the cost of those COLAs. This is the table from the April meeting. The 3 COLAs that I recommended are the kind of the middle 3 COLAs there. The actuarial impact to those 3 COLAs ranged between $137 million and $165 million to the actuarial liability, and the increase to the normal cost was between 0.3 and 0.5% for those 3. So they were modest on the chart. This next slide was, yes, it's the right slide. also from your April presentation hasn't changed. The three COLAs I was looking at averaged an increase in the total APC on an annual basis over the 30 years of about 2%. So you would take that 50% contribution rate on that slide with all of the percentages and add 2% to implement these COLAs. And you can see here the cost under each of the ABC scenarios where it was under the traditional 11 to 12.
Not 50% plus 2%. It's 2% of 50%.
It's 50% plus 2.
Plus 2. Okay. So
good. Under the three-year step-up, it would be $4 million in 2025 and 3-5-year step-up, step-down. This slide, I think, is a new slide.
Yeah.
Is it new? Okay. I thought it was a new slide. So this slide I like, and what this slide was helpful for me in really identifying which of these I think is the best COLA option. This slide shows the purchasing power for a 2023 retiree, which was kind of different than the other purchasing power slide, or purchasing power slides you've seen before. So the COLA options are along the side here, and you can see over time what happens to these retirees. And the COLA I'm recommending is not the most expensive one or the best one, even the Chiron models here. It's a 70% one because it seemed reasonable. The immediate partial COLA, the kind of the two in the middle, were better for retirees early on, but it didn't stop the erosion long term. So I was looking for a COLA that stopped the long-term erosion. That's why I selected the, I'm recommending the 70% purchasing power COLA. I can tell you the city does not like purchasing power COLA. And the reason is that I've been told is from the CFO, Jack Ireland, is then all the employees are going to want their pay to go up because their purchasing power is going down. But, and it's complicated, and it is complicated about that. I give you that. I'll talk more about that structure as we go forward. So just to look at the cost, to isolate the cost of the 70% purchasing power COLA, just because of the ADC, we talked about this last time, contributions, the current COLA is increasing the liability by $94 million. If we add the 70% purchasing power COLA, the actuary liability goes up another $142 million and 3% to the normal cost. And I talked about these numbers on the last slide. So the bottom shows the 2025 cost of the 70% purchasing power COLA. This page you've seen before, and this is the 70% purchasing power. This one is different where that last one just talked about really the top line here. If you retire in 2023, you can see those numbers match the prior slide, what happens. But the people that have retired before that haven't gotten a COLA, they've already had erosion of their benefit. This COLA is not going to make up for that erosion. What would happen is we would take a baseline amount of this is the value of your benefit in 2024, and then the CPI would be calculated from 2024 forward to determine when they hit 70% erosion. So that's why you can see that some of these people that have retired between 2022 and basically 2005, they will actually be down to 53%, 53-60%. But we're not saying that they would go up to 70. It's going to be 70% from today forward. And that's where it gets complicated. And because we're starting today, right, everybody would be starting at 2024 is 100%. It's going to take about 15 years for this COLA to kick in once you factor in the average CPI. So there won't be any COLA for 15 years, which leads to why we need a bridge COLA. So a little bit more, I may have already said this on the 70% purchasing power COLA. Again, the reason I'm recommending this COLA over the others is when I look at the others, other than a direct CPI-based COLA, this one directly addresses the principles of benefit erosion. And I think this one has the best long-term protection for the employees than the other COLAs that Chiron recommended. But it doesn't do everything, like I said. That's why we need bridge COLA and why we need the modifications of the others. So That is the COLA you've seen before, a little more information on the 70%. Do you have questions on that COLA before I move on?
What was the cost difference between the 70 and 80 in that slide that you turned on?
The 80% would increase the, go back.
Isn't it on 85?
So the 80% purchasing power COLA is the second to last line here. Oh, I don't have it on that slide.
It's slide 15.
Yeah.
Oh, 15?
Yeah.
Is that 15?
Yeah.
85, yeah.
Oh, okay. No, I did have it. I didn't have the compounding one. So if we go back one more, I was on the right slide. So the increase from the into the actuarial liability, instead of being $142 million, it would be $341
million.
So for the liability, it would be a lot more, $200 million more. And for the ADC in 2025,
oh, wow.
It would go from $11 million to $27 million. And the average ADC over 30 years would be almost 5%. So a big difference.
Yeah, yeah.
Big difference.
Yeah, they're not.
Okay. So moving on, you can see that the little bar on the left side has now changed from new COLA to bridge COLA. So we're now talking about an additional COLA in addition to this 70% one. You've not seen any of this before. This is a new concept that came out of a meeting that we had with Mayor Pro Tem Max, where we're talking about what can we do to bridge between now and when a COLA kicks in. So I asked Chiron, run the COLA ideas that were presented at the city's meeting in April and come up with some other creative ideas on what to do to bridge the time frame. So I have these five options they came up with. They used 1% and $5, knowing that if you decided it's 2% or 3% or 4%, you could just multiply the impact. So that's why it's 1%. So the five options were doing a 13th check equal to 1% or whatever percent of the original pension amount. So by a 13th check, what that means is you get a check, but it doesn't add into your base benefit. So your base benefit doesn't go up. You just get this check, and if you get it every year, you just get that, but it doesn't add on. You get it one time, you just get that one check. The idea that the city presented at their last meeting was a simple COLA in 2025, so an actual COLA that does add to your benefit, an ongoing thing, but just for people that were retired before 2025. And I mentioned to Jack Ireland that I thought that would cause people to try to retire in 2025, especially if it was like 4% COLA. I mean, you're going to have to work more than a year and a half to get that 4% bump in your pay to get there. So I could see people wanting to retire. So he added in his presentation, you would do, which is item C, 1% in 2025 or 3 years after. But it's basically one COLA. It's one COLA and then a COLA sometime in the future, 2046 or whatever. That's what those two are. And the other two were similar to the supplemental COLA we talked about last time, but this is just a bridge. So it's $5 per year of service, not starting when you retire, but starting in either 2023 or 27. That's a lot. Are there questions on these? I talked about that. I can tell you what, as we go through this, well, the next slide actually shows you the cost of 1%. So the cost of the different ones, or the five bridge COLAs are down below on the bottom part of this chart. They range between $8 million increase in the liability to $78 million increase in the liability. And there's no increase, there's just a 0.1% increase in the normal cost. On it. Annual basis in 2025.
Kelly, I have one clarification.
Sure.
If you go to slide 91, where you have the long-term COLA liability 5485. See that? Right there.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's
Yes.
That's if that was adopted. If we did one of the other five below, would it be 5485 plus the increase in the liability? So
yes.
Picking the 60 number, that's easier. The five-year service, it would be 5485 plus 60, so 5545.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Right.
So I've kind of built this into what's going to happen with just the ADC and then what happened with the new COLA that I'm already recommending. And then,
how should we think of the normal cost differential? Because when you look at the dollars, the increase in the liability obviously is significant, but the normal cost, you know.
So what that's telling you is, and it makes sense, right? So since these are bridge COLAs, most of the money is going to people that are already retired. Some of it's going to go to people that will retire in the future. So most of the benefit of the bridge COLAs are for retirees. So it doesn't build into the normal cost of an active member currently working. That's why you're seeing that differential much more so here. It does have some impact, but not as much. Okay. So there's a very small increase, again, under the kind of the step-up provisions between $0 and $1 million a year. For these different COLAs, and there's additional, it's between $1 and $5 million. And obviously, once you get more payroll, it gets more expensive. But this is 2025 numbers, so you can see kind of where they are. They're all pretty similar at these percentages. So, my recommendation, I basically made this recommendation because it seemed like it would be meaningful to the retirees as a bridge COLA. And I wasn't hearing anything really from the city to work from. So this is where I ended up. So I am recommending the $5 per year of service for people that retired since 2017 plus the current COLA. It's certainly not the least expensive, as it adds $60 million to the liability. But the way that it works is it operates like a 13th check. So you'll get one in the way that they have it modeled, one in October of 2025, and then one every year after that. And it would go up basically $5 times your years of service every year. So there's an example at the bottom here of 2025, it would be $800. Then you have another year in retirement in 2026, it would be $900. And then go up every year. So it kind of operates a little bit like a COLA in the fact that it's increasing every year, it just doesn't build it. Questions? One more. Okay. So that's it for the bridge COLA. This is to remind you of what's currently in the statute on our current COLA. So this is where I'm getting to the last part. You've seen this information before, most of it. So just to remind you, in 2017, we went down to Austin. It was a very difficult time. We were trying to save the plan. At that point, the plan had 7 years until we ran out of money. The city had other issues that they were dealing with, the pay lawsuits that they ended up issuing, hundreds of millions of dollars of debt to cover. They had a bond issue that they wanted to do. And, you know, we were struggling, kind of like we are now, to get funding into the plan. So benefits were cut. Part of that benefit cut was coming up with a COLA that could be modeled in and have minimal impact. And that's where we came up with. Nobody said this was the right COLA structure. It wasn't the conversation. It was just put in there. So if people are saying, well, we have this current COLA because somebody thought it was a good idea, I was down there. That wasn't the conversation. But it is what's in the statute. So we need to modify it, in my opinion. So right now, the current COLA says we have to have an average return, five-year return above 5%. You can't get a COLA until the plan is 70% funded. You get one once you've been retired for 3 years or at least 65 years old, and the board must approve it, so it's an ad hoc COLA. The way that it's calculated is take what you returned over a five-year period, subtract 5%. If it's more than that, you have a COLA. If it's less, then you don't. And it's a simple COLA, so it's on your base benefit, not your whole benefit, not compounding. So the way that Chiron has it modeled, they built in a 1.5%. They've assumed we're going to make our 6.5% every year, minus 5, 1.5%. That's what's built in, starts in 2046 that we've talked about. and they've said we should have more COLA sooner. That's my note. All right, so this is now a new section, how we I think that we would recommend possible modifications for the COLA. These we talked about last month, I haven't changed them. So we would change the COLA from an ad hoc COLA to a shall grant automatic COLA. The COLA would be 1.5% instead of the possibility they can go up to 4%. It would be 1.5% on the base benefit. The COLA would be granted when we're at above 70% funding, and the employee's retirement fund grants a COLA of any amount, and I'll explain that in a minute. We would remove the requirement to be either 62 or 3 years retired. Okay. So some of the reasons I'm trying to do this I've talked about already. I think tying the COLA directly to the CPI, like this does by tying it to the ERF COLA is tied to the CPI, addresses the principles of benefit erosion. The COLA based on investment returns has nothing to do with benefit erosion, so I think it's a faulty idea. Tying the COLA to ERF is really because there's many ways to calculate what would change in CPI, and Citi has adopted the ERF way of calculating their change in CPI, so if we tie to them, we're not having different, you know, we have a CPI that's based on something that their CPI is not based on, it's just cleaner, I think. We would still need to be 70% funded before we get the COLA, and I know the fear from the city is we would be granting a COLA when we have losses. And that is possibly true. But we can't have too many losses because we have to be 70% funded.
Mm-hmm.
So the gains and losses still are going to impact when a COLA can happen in this fund.
So to your point, the gains and losses have to happen above 70% threshold anyway.
Right.
So, okay.
Exactly. So there is some, I mean, yes, on a yearly basis, you could have that situation, just as ERF had a loss in 2022 and gave a COLA. You know, it could happen. The modifications here do not increase the cost because this is how Chiron modeled it at 1.5%.
Is the city indicated that they have no issue with the concept of the ERF kind of parity?
They don't like that at
all.
Okay. They don't like it at all.
Why? They say?
Because they're a separate plan and they should be treated differently. And I think their fear is we're trying to lower what ERF has. But I'm trying to tie it. I think it makes sense on the COLA to tie it there. But speaking of ERF, here's a slide. So, and I wanted to compare. I mean, the ERF benefits are much greater than our members' benefits. And I'm working on a slide on that. It's not in this presentation, but I'll have a comparison for you at some point. So the ERF COLA happens regardless of the funding level of the plan. Their funding level on a market value of basis was not 70% in 2022. It was 73% on a market, on an actuarial value basis. I'm getting this from a GRS report on their website. But anyway, ours would have to be 70% funded. Theirs does not have a funding requirement. Our COLA is 1.5% under this modified approach. Currently, there are 11,400 members in ERF that their COLA is capped at 5%. 7,900 of those are retirees. Another 3,500 of those are still working. They still get that up to 5% COLA when they retire. They have another 4,300 active employees in there currently in their Tier B. If they make it to retirement, they'll get a COLA up to 3%. So our 1.5 is half of their lowest tier. My bottom bullet is true. An employee that is hired today in any department other than the sworn police and fire police officers and firefighters have a better COLA than somebody who's already spent their whole career working for the city. So the modifications we're asking for here are not excessive, aggressive, or not really even in aligned really with ERF.
This is the kind of thing that we say it, they don't really want to talk about it, but to the extent that this goes down to the state legislature, this would be a point of emphasis. Just relative fairness and all that. I mean, the fact that we're underfunded from past mistakes, really not fault of anyone in the plan. So this could be a major point of discussion going forward if we can't come to consensus soon.
It's a little complicated.
It is complicated,
okay,
and I'm glad you said that. Because
I'm trying to wrap my head around it.
Right, and I understand for the members it is complicated. So you know, one of the things I plan to do is have conversations with Siegel, as Ben, because Siegel needs to weigh in on these ideas as well, and Chiron, because I've taken, in all honesty, my Chiron information, slice and dice, you know, put things together, and maybe there's an easier way to get here than what I've got going on here.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the concepts, right? I like trying to fix the benefit erosion, trying to have a long-term way to fix the benefit erosion. I like the idea of having some bridge, and if we keep the current COLA in place, modify it, because I don't think it makes sense the way it is. But I do like the idea of trying to simplify it.
And I'm going to try and ask a question that may not even make sense, but when you were speaking, you talked about a payment or a benefit that was given to the retiree but wasn't compounding. Was that part of the bridge or component of it?
Are you talking about on
the... Because you're saying something to the effect that... Like, there's a component of it that says, okay, so you have two, right? You have the bridge for the ones that are kind of doing the catch-up, so to speak. And then there's the one and a half, correct? Or is that, like...
So the 1.5% COLA wouldn't kick in until we're 70% right. funded. The bridge goes away once we're 70%. You would never have the two together.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, once you cross over the bridge, then the bridge is gone.
Okay.
Now we got metaphors on.
Would you like me to go?
No. Oh. So one point I want to, and we've talked about this in the past, and just want to make sure the board understands this. So it may seem odd, you know, funding, these are funding changes, trying to make us better funded, or adding liability with the COLA. You know, the statute is clear. The statute says that the independent actuary, which is Chiron, is tasked to look at benefit and contribution changes. It did not say benefit decreases in contribution changes. The statutory language is very clear. So when Chiron came back with their initial recommendation of a COLA, Kelly and I did question them, and they had their reasons, and they're the actuary, and we're not. And so we have followed that. The city has basically stood on its head and screamed bloody murder up till today to say that this is outside the scope of the statute. And we have been very clear to say, no, it is right within the scope of the statute, because this was from the independent actuary, and they think it's part of the mix to get you. Really, all that the statute requires is that you make contribution and benefit changes to get you to 30 years funding. And so Chiron has given the board its recommendations on how to achieve that. So from my perspective and Kelly's perspective, we think the board's absolutely within its statutory right to adopt a plan that has some form of COLA, because that's based in the Chiron report, which is what the statute requires. So you are on absolutely firm ground to go ahead and adopt some form of whatever, you know, what Kelly's recommending or some variation thereof.
All right, this slide, it just is a summary of the three COLAs, the current COLA kicking in sooner, the 94 million you've seen before, the 70% purchasing power, 142, so five 5-year bridge goal is the 78. These are just numbers you've seen before, but summarized here. So combining that with my recommendation of the 3-year step up, I have that the 2025 cost highlighted here. So again, in total for 2025, the difference between what the city's preferred 5-year step up is would be about $22 million. That one item says not available because they didn't model the exact structure for that, but it's going to be less than the $3 million in the column to the left. So $31 million versus $22 million, the total delta that we have right now. And that's all I have on the COLA. The longer I think about it, the more complicated I think it gets. But I do think that I like my thinking now on the goal of the COLA. It's more clear, more crystallized once I really see that it fits nicely within the guidelines that the CRB sets a good pension plan to have. So we'll continue to work with the city. There may or may not be another meeting. There might be a meeting this afternoon. I don't know. There may or may not be a special meeting of the pension ad hoc pension committee, and then we may ask you for a meeting as well.
Kelly, how come this current, the purchasing power like adjustment for the 5-year step up wasn't calculated?
So we've had, I can't tell you how many models we've had, hundreds, but so it just happened to be the version that they put the 70% step up on the, so at one point the city, actually the new city manager, I guess, recommended doing the 5-year step up, step down. So when we asked them to run this, they were using that one and not it. It's just complicated. That's why. But we would run it if we ended up there.
Okay.
We have probably a couple hundred.
It seemed like it would be somewhere between the other two.
Oh, it's going to be
less
than the three.
You know what I mean? It's like three and a half.
It's less than the three. No,
yeah, right.
Yeah, it'll be less than three. But I don't have the
do y'all kind of see the path on the substance and the process, kind of where this is going? Kelly, the analyst, the managing director, the VP, the negotiator, the rescuer, and all in one on this. So, but everyone kind of sees what we're doing. Does anyone have, a great comment, Matt, on, one of the three considerations? Is there anything else you kind of want to nudge us on or create, guidepost or strongly object to? And we'll continue. I mean, the goal is to have both this board and then the ad hoc committee and hopefully the full city council adopt the same plan. That's the goal. But because we are coming at it from different places and there's inherent conflict in this process, there has to be something else that we can't come to agreement. That would be that picks a state legislature next year. There is a different viewpoint, I think, from the city, not wanting to speak for them, I'm just regurgitating what I've heard, and Josh in my comment, where Josh's view is if we adopt a plan, then that becomes law. I think it's fair to say they have a different interpretation of that. And ultimately, they're the ones that have to write the check. So, if that becomes its own process, if we get to that point.
If we adopt a plan, they don't necessarily have to.
Our view is that is the law.
Yeah, but that's the same.
And they have a different view.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a whole process to resolve, people view the implementation of law differently. But you see where that'll go. It'll end up with the state legislature or perhaps some other adjudicating process. I think we have our arms around the facts, the information, the priorities, and everyone okay with the process we're on. We'll go ahead and move on.
I have one question. Just in terms of the process, We're obviously getting to the point where it seems like there's a narrowing, at least a little winnowing where the stress points are, and there are many. But if you're getting down to the nitty-gritty of actual negotiating points, are we to just come back here in 2 weeks and decide on a plan, or will there be any form of communication as to, again, I'm not quite certain exactly where we are in the negotiations with their negotiators, but it would seem that we would need to have some form of prepping for where we are and what we're deciding is acceptable and what we as a board is deciding are not acceptable terms.
So I didn't do it. I realized this when you were talking, Mark, that I didn't. I mean, I told you where the city, the delta between where we are on the ADC and where the city is on the ADC, the 3 years versus the 5 years. The employee contribution piece we talked about, I didn't really tell you where I believe the city staff is. I don't know where the staff is on the COLA. So,
and is it because they haven't articulated, or is it because it's relatively new?
I'm trying to remember what was said at the last meeting.
I think there's an education issue.
Yeah.
There's a process issue internally for them. They don't have their, I do not believe they have their arms around it within the body that can agree to things
right.
Like we do. Because we have Kelly, who obviously is relying on her team, but she owns it in a way. I don't see someone over there or how they. It looks like they process some decisions. I think Jack understands better. Mayor Pro Tem Atkins, who really, I've been very pleased with the goodwill with him and everything, but I don't think he knows it as well as Jack. And so it's just a process.
I mean, the reality is that this is the only thing that we manage, and they're in all kind of directions. So a lot of it is technical, and I mean, just sitting here listening to all these options, I find it they're understaffed. And anyway, that's they're probably not don't have their hands around it because. They just haven't sat on it long enough.
Well, and they also have, I mean, they have their budget constraints, right? And what they're being told by their professionals and the budget is you've got this much money. So they're kind of trying to work to that. And if I think back to the last meeting, the voices that were in, the eight council members that were in the meeting, I think they were in different places on the COLA. Some of them don't think there should be a COLA because it's not required. Other people were more in favor of a COLA. They were kind of, in very different places. The CFO, Mr. Ireland, has indicated that what he wants is one COLA now, and I think it's so they can, people can say, hey, we gave you a COLA, so they stop saying, we haven't gotten a COLA since 2016. So one COLA now, and a stipend later if certain criteria are met. Like you exceed 6.5% rate of return, something like that. But there's no guarantees to those. I don't like those options. So that's kind of the delta on the COLA is big. It's fast.
Well, but it seems to me that we're negotiating, but we really are not negotiating because at the end of the day, we're both approving separate. We have our own obligation as to what we negotiate. And hopefully, there's a meeting in the mind. I guess I'm just a little unclear as to the process. What are we delegating to you? What's really coming back to us? Is something going to come back to us that in some ways has already been somewhat approved or part of that delegation of authority that you guys have, which I have no problem with, but it seems a little bit of a chicken and egg thing in terms of what's going to come back to us. In 2 weeks, because obviously, well, maybe 2 weeks, we don't know. So
I think what I'd like to sort of propose or walk us towards is that that we ultimately the city council has to be the only group that can bind the city, and this board is only the group that can bind the pension. So, you know, technically anything Kelly, and myself and Josh, upon advisement, say, okay, you know, we shake hands on that. I mean, it's all subject to each of our constituents, because that's just the way that, that it works. I think that what makes sense would be if we feel like we're just about there or we're at a much tighter bid ask on something, that we would try to have, could we have a call where we're just sort of, advising? Yeah, we're not.
A special meeting, sure.
Yeah, and I don't think that would be the time to vote.
Right.
I think we would then have to have another meeting just to the vote, but we would say, hey, kind of an advisement, we're close, and get a consensus, and that sort of thing.
That's exactly where,
okay.
I didn't want to say it, but you said it. I think that's
so part of the challenge, though, is even that call would be an open session, right? Because, I mean, it's a challenge.
Yeah.
If I said something today on one of these recommendations that you don't like at all and you think we should go somewhere, I can't have you talking to each other. That's an open meetings issue, but feel free to call me. I mean, Matt and I had a good conversation, and it made me rethink about where am I on this employee contribution issue. So if you don't feel comfortable with something I've said or feel like we should draw a hard line somewhere, call me directly.
Well, let's be clear. If we're actually having negotiations and no open meetings fairly decently, that discussion can be done in the executive session with certain parameters.
I don't. Let me think about that one, because there's not really a. Let me think about that one.
Sure.
That one.
But I like the concept of having something prior to actually us in best case scenario that we come to an agreement on. But I would not want it to be that we come to the meeting and then have to vote on something that we know the parameters of, but we don't really know the details. It'd probably be good for us to know a little bit more of where a penultimate place.
Yeah, I mean, most likely in that call, we probably are down to a tight bid ask on maybe one issue, and you know, we're trying to gain a consensus on that. And I mean, that would be probably the practical side. And then I just think, in a real healthy way, we have to know that we can adopt the plan we want, even if we don't have common ground with the city, and just walk through that contingent process that you know, involves the state legislature in the next session. So that is a way to go, and we all can make our own judgments on, given the deal that's on the table, is that something we're willing to say, no, we're going to go this way.
And the state legislature would, if it went to that point, they would either accept the proposal.
They can do anything.
They basically have veto. They can literally, pun not intended, lay down the law. I'm a little bit more skeptical about going that, because that's the Pandora's box that you don't know what you're going to come out with.
Right. Yeah.
Wouldn't we have time once we know the lay of the land and the roadmap and so forth, and we know what conclusion we'd like to get to before we go to the legislature, sit down with some of the staff, the legislative members, to help educate them in the process?
I mean, that if we end up down at the legislature, that will be time effort.
Right, that's true. But, you know, flip side is also true. The city is doing the same thing, and the city's bigger. So, you know, like Mark said, I think it's a Pandora's box a little or a lot. You know?
Our Schrodinger's cat, so I get our lives.
So everyone, we have kind of a view on process, major issues, and we'll
proceed accordingly. But something I'd ask is that you get a call, you know, and Melissa says, hey, you know, are you free later this afternoon or tomorrow? We'll try to do as much heads-up notice, but, you know, it could be really tight time turnaround, get, you know, everyone involved, and we'll do our best to make it as easy as possible. So, but it probably...
Are you talking about a meeting?
No, well, just what we said, which is that if we're close, we think, to a deal that we all feel like we can accept and we want to gain that kind of consensus from all of you prior to then another meeting, which would be a vote, that's what we're talking about.
Oh, I was just saying that I think you have to have at least 72 hours.
If a call would still be a meeting, that would have to be posted. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is good.
Okay. All
right. Okay.
Tanella works hard on me. I tell you, he's calling me all the time.
He does. So do you want to talk about some actuarial stuff?
Okay, Kelly.
All right, so this next item, Jeff Williamson Siegel might be on the phone. I don't know if he is, but in case you have questions, this is a very simple item. Every year, we usually have Jeff come in and talk to you about the assumptions used for the next valuation that they're preparing, but we're not recommending any changes to the assumptions, so I didn't think he needed to come all the way here to tell you that. The process would be, well, my recommendation is we use the same assumptions in the 2024 valuation that we used in the 2023 valuation. He doesn't see a reason to change anything, and I don't either. Next year, when we get ready to do the 1/1/25 valuation, we're required to do an experience study, and I would expect some changes to come out of that. So, any questions on assumptions?
Okay, so then we need a motion to direct Siegel to use the same assumptions for the January 1st, 2024 actuarial evaluation that were used in the January 1st, 2023 actuarial evaluation for the combined plans, both the regular and the supplemental. Someone make that motion. Second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Okay, ministerial actions. Kelly.
Okay. Your report is included in your packet, page 104. We had a little uptick in retirements that are shown here. Oddly, this month we've had more walk-in retirements than we've had. I mean, you're required to make an appointment, but on the police side, for some reason, we're having people frustrated and walking in to retire immediately. That's always not a good sign. We'll see what the numbers look like next month. With that, the only change here really is under the service purchases. You can see there's seven. We are now allowing people to buy their time back for workers' comp related items.
Great.
So that's why that's up a little bit. That's actually a variety. There was three workers' comp, and then the rest were normal service purchases. Other than that, nothing was unusual this month. Okay. Any questions on that? Next item is the regular trustee training item. There's a lot of NCPRS classes listed on here. If you're interested in attending, let us know. I think, Tag, you said you might want to attend one. We still have to put it on the next level as well. Actually, Sasha.
I think just reading the Chiron report to get a little bit of education.
Yeah.
Just trying to understand all that.
Can we count that as continuing?
That's for sure.
Okay. All right, Ryan.
All right. All right, portfolio update. Simple, given the last item and the next two. So through April, the portfolio is up 1.7%. For the entire portfolio and 3.1% for the public portfolio, which is 72%. Private market asset sales have been slow this year, with $8 million coming back here to date compared to $69 last year. In mid-April, looking at kind of equity market levels and the level of the safety reserve, we decided to rebalance $28 million from global equity back into the safety reserve and cash, which extended the time frame for that out, and that was kind of a good chance to trim from equity markets with the run-up. this year. On the custodian search, we have issued an RFP, and we expect responses back on Monday. On that, Callan's assisting us with the search and evaluating the RFPs. Moving forward on investment initiatives, we've been working through the asset allocation with the IAC. Looks like we're going to end up moving that meeting into July because we're trying to get a quorum of the IAC, but we have a few mixes that we've been talking about and working through with Makita. We're trying to get the new private market consultant, Allborn, to come to that meeting too to talk about the possible addition of private credit into the asset allocation. Would expect the custodian selection decision to come to the board in Q3, as well as asset allocation. And then once we get, we're going to need to do IPS modifications for both the new asset allocation and then the inclusion of some private market assets. So once we've actually engaged Allborn and they're doing work, we're going to have them look at our IPS and make some recommendations on what to add on the private market side. Forward, kind of just went over the asset allocation timeline a minute ago. On the equity market returns, I think just, you know, with the run-up that we've seen in the last 18 months, I've kind of said this the last few months, but if you look at our equity benchmark, the ACWI IMI, it's basically flat from the beginning of 2022. So we've kind of had a drawdown and a recovery. EM is the one still trailing quite a bit. This slide is from the JP Morgan Guide to the Markets. Just looking at the credit markets, a few things to point out here is the blue bars on the left there, that's high yield maturities that are coming up. So there's kind of a maturity wall coming up in the high yield markets. And then on the bottom right of this chart, it's showing default rates in the credit markets, and they're starting to spike a little bit. So we're keeping an eye on that. So in our public portfolio, we're out earning a 60-40 overall time period. If you look at it to the 5-year, which is hard to see, but we're up 6.2% versus a 5% 60-40 benchmark. Same kind of story on global equity. We're slightly below on public equity, and that's the effect of the EM allocation when you add that into the global equity to get to the total public equity allocation. On fixed income, looking on the three-year column here, all of our active managers are outperforming their benchmark except for the high-yield Loomis fund. And it's, as part of the allocation, we're kind of looking at restructuring the way we're looking at the credit, public credit portion of the fixed income portfolio, so there could be some changes coming out of that.
Hey, Ryan.
Yeah.
Do we, as we look for fixed income, do you have, like, as you have your screen criteria, is there a minimum AUM or asset size per fund that, like, you cut off where you won't go below?
I mean, when we've done public searches before, it kind of depends on the asset class. But we don't want to be too much of a fund. So it's been probably $500 million plus for a public fund when we're screening in investment.
Okay. All right, thanks.
So on the bridge chart, we're basically flat year-to-date with $1.942 billion in AUM, with $34 billion in outflows and $33 million in investment gain in income. This is looking at the private asset inflow coverage of the net benefit outflows. With this year being down a little bit, we're right at 98% since the beginning of 2018. So the safety reserve dashboard, we're basically back full with the rebalancing that we did in April, so we have enough coverage for the next 21 months or through the end of 2025. And then on the asset allocation detail, the only thing I'd point out here is you can see the 6% targets under global equity to the four active managers, Boston Partners, Manulife, Walter Scott, and WCM. When we rebalanced those, they were getting a little bit above the six targets, so we brought that back down to six each when we did the $28 million rebalancing in April. Any questions on the portfolio? Okay.
So we have an executive session now.